Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a quotation we encountered a little earlier today. It starts like this. There is a widespread belief that existing unemployment is the result in large part of the gross inequality in the distribution of wealth and income, which giant corporations have fostered, that by the control which the few have exerted through giant corporations, individual initiative and effort are being paralyzed. Now, to me, that quotation feels urgently contemporary. But it was written in 1933 by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, a man whom constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen calls the most prescient judicial philosopher of the 20th century. Now, prescient in his distrust of big banks and big government, prescient in his view that a living constitution can protect privacy even as technology advances, prescient in his embrace of American pluralism, all of which is why Rosen argues Brandeis matters now more than ever. And he makes that argument in his new book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen will be discussing Brandeis at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, but he joins us in our studios now. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, and thank you for that superb introduction. That just sums up the greatness of Brandeis so well.
Well, it was pretty easy for me since you make such a powerful argument in your book, and there is much to discuss. This is one of those conversations that we could go on for a long, long time, but I will try to pick the highlights, of which there are many. I wanted to actually start off by noting that next month marks the 100th anniversary of Justice Brandeis's confirmation, right?
It does. June 1st, 1916, he was confirmed. He is nominated on January 28th, so he waited 125 days between nomination and confirmation. That's the longest wait any nominee has had so far. If Merrick Garland still doesn't have a hearing by July 19th, if I counted right, then Garland will surpass that record.
Okay. So what was it that took Brandeis's confirmation hearing? What made it so long? Was he controversial at the time?
He sure was.
And part of the controversy. Question.
Yes, exactly. It's funny you should ask that question. He was remarkably controversial for a number of reasons. Most importantly, because of the crusading anti-corporate populism that you quoted from in that incredibly eloquent Ligon Lee opinion on the Supreme Court. He's known as the people's attorney in Boston. He makes his name with his attacks on the Boston Consolidated Gas Company. Doesn't that sound menacing? And the New Haven Railroad. And essentially, he's insisting that the greedy banks are taking reckless risks with other people's money. That's the immortal, memorable phrase of his 1913 book. So this gets a lot of opposition, especially in Boston. It's great to talk about him here. And there was this remarkable chart that used to hang in the offices of the New Republic, where I worked for a long time, that showed the arrayed Boston interests that were opposing his confirmations, led by President Abbott Lawrence Lowell of Harvard, whose anti-Semitic policies that excluded Jews. Mm-hmm. Lowell was not a fan of Brandeis for his religion as well. And then State Street bankers and other interests. And finally, it goes up to the editor of the New Republic, but his son-in-law works for J.P. Morgan, the oligarch who Brandeis is always attacking. So they kill the chart, and it hung in the New Republic office.
Well, so just to be clear, I mean, this is a chart that Brandeis or someone from his law firm sent to the New Republic to literally show the interconnectedness of power and financial interests in Boston who had allied against him and opposed his confirmation to the Supreme Court.
Precisely. It's done by the New Republic editors in conversation with Brandeis's supporters.
Yeah.
And it's a literal illustration of the very point Brandeis is making in other people's money, that oligarchic webs of influence are thwarting the public interest.
Well, the book is so fascinating because there's even, you have something that President William Howard Taft had written about Brandeis at the time. And I mean, I just have to read a little bit of it to show how passionately opposed some of the most powerful people in America were to putting Brandeis on the court. Taft had said that he is a muckraker, an emotionalist for his own purposes, a socialist prompted by jealousy, a hypocrite, a man who has certain high ideals in his imagination but who is utterly unscrupulous in method in reaching them, a man of infinite cunning, of great tenacity of purpose, and in my judgment, of much power for evil.
Yes. Remarkable, isn't that? And this is, you know, the president of the United States. Taft, of course, has a grudge because Brandeis has embarrassed him in a congressional hearing where there was an environmental scandal, and Brandeis basically proves that Taft had lied about backdating a certain document. It's the Watergate hearings of its day. The cover-up is worse than the crime. Also, Taft is yearning to be on the Supreme Court himself and just poignantly hopes that Woodrow Wilson is going to appoint him to the court, even though Wilson had just defeated him. So there was a personal grudge. Remarkably, Taft is appointed Chief Justice a few years later, fulfilling his lifelong dream, and he and Brandeis make up, and they both care so passionately about the institutional legitimacy of the court that Brandeis joins all sorts of opinions, and Taft burbles happily. You know, all goes very well in the conference room, so they did bury the hatchet.
So on June 1st, 1916, Louis Brandeis gets confirmed, and he joins the U.S. Supreme Court, and you write how his judicial philosophy can roughly be described as resting on three pillars: a commitment to judicial restraint, which we'll talk about in a moment, that crusading opposition to big corporations in America and their potential effect on democracy, and the idea that the Constitution is a living document that can use the totality of American history to that point in order to assess or take a look at important issues coming before the court. So those are the three pillars here. I just wanted to put that out there because I wanted to step back actually in time a little bit and ask you, where did Brandeis's judicial philosophy come from? What were the major influences on his life?
The major influence, I end up concluding, was Thomas Jefferson. And I make the claim that he was the greatest critic of bigness in both business and government since Thomas Jefferson. He was the Jewish Jefferson in the sense. And he came to that sort of later in life. It was not until the 1920s that he started reading deeply in Jefferson and quoting him in his inaugural address and his letters. And like Jefferson, Brandeis views American history as a clash between oligarchic financiers and producers and agrarian farmers. And he thinks that constitutionally, you have to protect the interests of producers against the financiers. And that just influences his whole vision of political economy and ultimately his judicial philosophy. He did care about judicial restraint in the sense of deferring to state laboratories of democracy and experimentation. But ultimately, he was a constitutional visionary who was enacting from the bench the very views that he had championed as an advocate. And in that sense, that made him incredibly influential, but it sort of transcended his commitment to judicial deference.
I mean, when you read the kinds of things that he wrote even prior to him joining the Supreme Court, they sound like they could have been written today. I mean, things like the American people have as little need of oligarchy in business as in politics. He railed against investment bankers after the turn of the century, even beforehand, saying that they take the golden eggs laid by somebody else's goose. I mean, and of course, for example, tell us about what his view was of people like J.P. Morgan, who, as you write, in 1911, controlled roughly 40% of the capital raised in America.
It's remarkable. I love the fact that you're reading from those excerpts. And it's really The Big Short of its day. Brandeis is making the exact same critique, and in this sense, he predicted the crash of 29. He says that J.P. Morgan is taking reckless risks with what he unforgettably calls other people's money because he's leading people to invest in financial instruments are so complicated that no one can possibly understand their value. Sound familiar? It's like credit default swaps. And Brandeis is criticizing the complexity of Morgan's oligarchic operations that ensure that he assumes none of the risks but gets all of the benefits, and when there's a crash, he can just run. It's a precursor of too big to fail. So his economic critique is connected to his theory of knowledge, which is that no person can master the facts that are necessary to understand an institution unless it's on a pretty small scale. And that was why he liked the states and why he liked small business and why he ultimately came to see in Israel and the kibbutzim the apotheosis of his Jeffersonian dream of a place where citizens could really govern themselves on a small scale.
In 1926, apparently, Brandeis observed You quote him as saying that, "I wish to record my utter inability to understand why a lot of folks don't go broke." And he predicted a financial breakdown within a year. He was just off by a couple of years.
Completely. And he's telling his brother that the stock market is a kind of legalized gambling. Brandeis always invests in completely conservative bonds. And through this conservative investing and very simple living, he becomes a millionaire when he's young and dies with $3 million, an amazing amount that sort of surprised his progressive acolytes. But it's just because of his he believed that he had to get this surplus to earn freedom. He said, "What I care about is freedom, and I want to invest my free time on behalf of the public interest." Mm.
Now, I was very taken by what you said a little earlier, that you call Brandeis the Jewish Jefferson, because you also talk about in the book, You give an example of how that actually played out in policies that he was able to enact or support, even right here in Massachusetts, that he, you say one of his great achievements as a reformer was in savings bank insurance in Massachusetts?
Yes. He's very keen on irregularity of employment. He thinks it's unfair that employers hire people for a little bit and then lay them off, and also that they have nowhere to save their money except in these usurious and risky instruments. So he doesn't like federal-level unemployment insurance like Social Security, but he thinks a state-level savings bank insurance that has sound banks that ensure a steady return will allow people to weigh out the waves of unemployment. And he considers that the perfect reform. And savings bank insurance celebrated its 100th anniversary here in Massachusetts not long ago. So it's just a great example for him of a local reform that helped Small business people and workers.
I'm speaking with Jeffrey Rosen. He is the president of the National Constitution Center and a professor at the George Washington University School of Law. His latest book is Lewis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. It is a fascinating look at the legacy and judicial philosophy and urgency of how Brandeis thought vis-a-vis our world today. And as we were talking about a little earlier, June 1st marks the 100th anniversary of Lewis Brandeis's confirmation to the United States Supreme Court back in 1916. We could talk a lot about Brandeis's view of too big to fail and banks, but I just wanted to move into another area that you hinted at a little earlier, where Brandeis was incredibly influential and prescient. And that was this idea of privacy and technology. Tell us about what the technological changes were in Brandeis's time that got him thinking about why our privacy needed protection.
So fascinating. The first technology is the Kodak camera and the tabloid press here in Boston that led him to believe that gossip that used to be whispered from the closets was shouted from the rooftops. And he's upset that his law partner, Charles Warren, this Boston Brahmin, is having his privacy invaded by the Boston tabloids who write about his parties. So Brandeis writes the most influential article about the right to privacy in history, 1890, The Right to Privacy, and he basically says aristocrats have to have the right to sue newspapers for invasions of their dignity and their honor. But then he thinks the better of it. He thinks, I'm not so happy with this article because really it clashes with free speech. So then he comes to rethink privacy in light of another technology, and that's wiretapping. And in the 1920s, he dissents from the court's decision to uphold warrantless wiretapping. And here his technological prophetic aspect is just stunning. He has in his files a clipping about television, a new technology, but he misunderstands it as a two-way technology. Basically, he anticipates Skype and webcams, and his law clerk says, "No, take that out." But then he has this incredible passage where he basically looks forward to the age of cyberspace and says, "Ways may someday be developed by which it's possible, without physically intruding into the home, to extract secret papers from drawers and introduce them in court. A far smaller invasion sparked the American Revolution with the general warrants that inflamed James Otis and John Adams." He says, "We have to translate the Constitution so it forbids the same kind of ubiquitous surveillance without physical trespass that the framers were appalled by." it's just it's stunning, and it can tell us more than any other opinion of Supreme Court history about how to think about drones that can fly over us and track us from door to door, about GPS or global positioning system tracking or geolocational tracking. Congress is debating this very question right now. Should there be a warrant if you want to track someone for a long time? Brandeis said it's not okay even with a warrant if it can reveal a tremendous amount of information about us, because we should have the right to control the exposure of our thoughts, sensations, and emotions. It's this very Jeffersonian notion that we have a natural right to control our thoughts and opinions. It's freedom of thought. It's cognitive liberty.
Did he take into account what the contemporary discussion frequently does, which is, what are the popular expectations of privacy?
No, that was a phrase that the court embraced in purporting to affirm Brandeis's notion that the Constitution protects people but not places. But the problem with that test, as many people have noted, is that our expectations of privacy are contingent on the privacy that we subjectively experience. So if the government goes on TV tomorrow and says, citizens, we're going to track you door to door with drones, then our expectations of privacy go down, and so do our protections. Brandeis was focused on the paradigmatic case of what was the harm of the general warrants that allowed the king to break into your house and read your private diaries without suspicion. It was that your thoughts, sensations, emotions, your ability to engage in political dissent could be challenged, and this was not consistent with the values of a free society. So that's why he's insisting on translating the values and saying not on the technicalities, but the principle the framers meant to protect, regardless of the means that are chosen to invade it.
Today, all day long, I was wondering what Justice Brandeis might have made of, this argument hasn't yet made it to the Supreme Court, but I think it might eventually. For example, the battle between Apple and the FBI.
Yes. Well, first of all, I love the fact that you're playing my favorite parlor game, WWBD, what would Brandeis do? And I was thinking the very same thing a few days ago. It's constitutional wonkery at its best.
That's what we do here.
Just trying to channel Brandeis on, but it's a great question. And I think he would have asked how much information is being revealed. If you're going to open up someone's cell phone and see their entire life, that could indeed threaten our unexpressed thoughts, sensations, and emotions. And how to balance that of the seriousness of the crime being investigated. So even if it's a suspected San Bernardino terrorist, I think Brandeis might have wanted some limit on the amount that you could search in the phone. So stuff that's relevant to the crime, perhaps you can get, but you can't get diaries and emails that are unrelated. And that balancing is something that the current courts have been unwilling to engage in because they've been focused on the legalistic, do you have a warrant or not? I think that's one possible challenge for Brandeis.
Well, speaking of WWBD, what would Brandeis do? You wrote about it in the book. What would he make of financial reform post 2008? Because it doesn't seem to be, Dodd-Frank, for example, doesn't seem to be at all along the lines of what Brandeis preferred, which was basically tax major financial corporations down to smaller sizes rather than regulation, per se.
That is exactly right. Dodd-Frank is a Theodore Roosevelt-like reform. Theodore Roosevelt, in the election of 1912, wants to have big regulatory bodies that oversee the big banks. Brandeis wants to break the banks up so that, as you say, they can be taxed by the states. So when Bernie Sanders evoked Theodore Roosevelt on behalf of his proposal to break up the banks, it was the wrong analogy. Actually, it's Brandeis and Wilson who were the precursors of Sanders. But of course, Sanders has a more Hamiltonian vision of the scope of federal government. Brandeis is more Jeffersonian. The part of Dodd-Frank he would have liked is the Volcker Rule, mm-hmm. which prohibits banks from proprietary trading on their own accounts. And that was something that had been guaranteed by, not to get too wonky, but the Glass-Steagall Act, which Brandeis inspired, separated commercial from investment banking from the 30s to 1992, and it was repealed during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, Morgan basically blamed Brandeis for Glass-Steagall in a way.
They did indeed. And some blame Morgan for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. But Dodd-Frank, he would have liked the Volcker Rule. He would have liked the caps on the capitalization requirements of Dodd-Frank, but the most Brandeisian reform, caps on the size of the banks, didn't pass because the administration in both parties is Hamiltonian and not Jeffersonian.
Yeah. So given all this that we've discussed about what Louis Brandeis thought about or the dim view he took of bigness of any sort, really, you also still approach Brandeis as a progressive, but what does his form of progressive judicial restraint really mean, though?
It means that the states, and perhaps the federal government too, should have broad discretion to experiment with progressive reforms. So from marriage equality to, I guess, the most obvious example now would be marijuana legalization. The question is, should the feds step in and preempt it, or should they allow the states to literally let a thousand flowers bloom? Brandeis would have said, yes, let the states play out a reform so that a consensus can develop and then it can be constitutionalized. I think President Obama has made a similar point in The Audacity of Hope. He said that liberals in the 60s became too reliant on the courts to impose reform from above. Instead, Obama said, and this is a very Brandeisian point, much reform throughout American history, from free speech to equality, has bubbled up from below. So it's basically, Brandeis is reminding progressives not to assume that all of the solutions can come from the federal government or from central authority, and to engage in the grassroots activism that can create consensus at the local level.
This is not the same type of judicial restraint that we commonly refer to today. I mean, the form of judicial restraint that's frequently talked about, it comes from more conservative judicial philosophy, right?
Well, you're right that restraint is evoked by both sides, and conservatives have said judges have to make the law, not enforce the law, not make it. Judicial restraint generally means I like what the courts are doing, and activism is I don't like it. But the most neutral definition of restraint is just courts not striking down laws, basically allowing legislatures to pass laws without striking them down. And in the progressive era, people from Theodore Roosevelt to Brandeis became so upset that courts were striking down all sorts of economic legislation that Roosevelt called for judicial decisions to be able to be overridden by popular vote. This completely appalled Taft and led to the split between them, because Taft was a real defender of judicial supremacy. So Brandeis just reminds us that the progressive tradition had been a suspicion of courts. The courts are bad things. They're based on economic oligarchs who will thwart progressive economic legislation. We should trust legislatures to actually experiment, and judges should have a light hand and not strike a lot of laws down.
So, you know, we must talk about one of the ways in which Louis Brandeis was very much an activist, even while he was on the bench, and that is he was the head of the American Zionist movement.
What an amazing story. So this is a secular Jew, grows up in Louisville, Kentucky, has a Christmas tree, is not observant. All of a sudden, in his 50s, he becomes the head of the Zionist movement. How did this happen? Almost a couple chance encounters. Jacob DeHaas, who's Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, had his American secretary, DeHaas, who was a journalist in Boston in his spare time. He goes to interview Brandeis about gas reform. And in the course of the conversation, mentions Louis Dembitz was a noble Jew. Dembitz was Brandeis's favorite uncle, an Orthodox Jew, one of three Jewish delegates to the Republican Convention of 1860 that voted for Abraham Lincoln. And Brandeis reveres him so much that he's fascinated to learn that Dembitz is a Zionist. So he starts reading about Zionism. Then later that year in 1910, he represents Jewish garment workers in a strike and meets Eastern European Jews for the first time. He's from Prague. His family is more aristocratic. And he's so impressed by the empathy of these Jewish garment workers and of the empathy of their Jewish employers, who are able to see both sides, that he starts reading more and more. And in time, he decides the Jews are a nationality and they need a home of their own. Every other nationality is a majority in at least one country. Jews should have one, too. And based on his incredible organizational abilities, within short order, he raises a lot of money. He has slogans like men, money, discipline, and he convinces Woodrow Wilson to persuade the British to issue the Balfour Declaration, which recognizes the state of Palestine. Brandeis is more responsible than any other American of the 20th century for the recognition of the state of Israel, and he did this in his spare time while he's on the Supreme Court, having been a completely unobservant and unengaged Jew for most of his life.
It's astonishing that a sitting justice, I mean, I'm looking at it through the eyes of sort of how we view the modern court, would be so vocal about something, because it's just impossible to imagine today. Does part of you wish that there were, that the justices today felt a greater degree of freedom to be advocates for whatever issue they might feel passionately about?
I don't know. It's a good and hard question. You're absolutely right. No one could get away with it today. I think you'd be impeached if you tried to do that today. And now we just don't trust mingling of the branches in the same way that was more common in Brandeis's day. In those days, President Harry Truman could invite the whole Supreme Court over to his for drinks after they ruled against him, and they could have bourbon together. Now we have ethics rules post-Watergate. So I think some of Brandeis's political activities may have been questionable even in their day. What I do lament is that you could have a justice who believed so passionately in certain principles like opposition to bigness, like the right of cultural pluralism and the need of all people to be able to be both Americans and to have their own nationalities. That kind of passionate devotion to constitutional ideals is something we're not cultivating in justices today, and that's a loss.
We just have a few seconds left. I told you we could talk about these about Brandeis for hours, but literally in the last couple seconds we have, why do you think there aren't more sort of followers of Brandeisism, if I can call it, today?
I think because he, on the one hand, is a libertarian and civil libertarian icon, and both the left and the right can converge around his opposition to monopoly power and to NSA surveillance, for example. But progressives have lost some of the Jeffersonian tradition, and Tea Party conservatives have lost the anti-corporate tradition. I'm hoping with this book to play a small role in galvanizing a pro-Brandeis movement to sweep the nation and remind both sides, liberals, libertarians, and conservatives, that this is a justice for all the people.
Well, the book is Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. It's by Jeffrey Rosen. He will be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight talking about it. There's more information at radioboston.org. Professor Rosen, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for a great conversation.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.